We'll see.
Tools for firewalling. So we can talk about the types of tools out there, their limitations, and some examples. So basically, you get your hardware tools, your software tools, which come in the free, share, fee, public, and other categories. You can get sample policies and documentation. You can get advice. You can get free advice, and it's worth everything you pay for it. Supposed to laugh there.
Thank you.
You can get search services, testing services, various vendors that will provide firewall services for you. You can get products that come with services, and you can get articles about the technologies and techniques, and there are even refereed journals that look at these issues. Of course, even if you've got all those tools, you would still need to decide what to do. You need to implement it, install it, configure it, operate it, manage it, convert your current systems, audit it, test it, and so forth.
So you know, you're sort of warned that what you get doesn't solve your problem.
It's just another arrow in your quiver. An example of a really useful tool that's been available for a number of years is TCP wrappers. I brought it up earlier, and I'll bring it up again. It's available for free over the internet. It is not shareware, it's freeware. Written by, I guess, White, the Anima. I'm not sure if I pronounced his name right. In fact, I almost certainly pronounced it wrong. And what happened is he was being attacked, and he didn't have the source of the operating system to fix it. And it was a weekend, and he said, what am I going to do? So what he did was he figured out how to put an intervening access control between the internet daemon, INetV, and the services, Telnet, FTP, and so forth. And so what he did was he said, told the internet daemon, INetV, that instead of calling in.telnet or telnet.d or whatever the program is that serves telnet requests, call my program, call TCP wrappers, and tell it to call telnet daemon. And then he wrote this TCP wrappers program, and the first version of it basically said what IP address is it from, looked at a configuration file that said if it's in this configuration file, don't let it through. Just say no. So it was a simple access. And over time, he made it so it had all sorts of additional features, and it's a pretty darn useful tool. And it's one of the basic tools that's now widely used in firewalls, and there are different names for it. People have different versions of it that they've written for scratch for their commercial products, but basically, no one's done any better than he did in the first place. It continues to be improved, and it's a staple tool of the industry. It provides access control for TCP services. It provides logging of access, allows some limited automated response, effectively on any request based on the source IP address, the source user, the destination IP address, the destination user, probably something else that I don't remember. You can run an arbitrary program, a shell script, for example, that takes as arguments the from address, the to address, the port, service, whatever. And then that program can decide what to do. So in fact, I wrote a program that when people tried to telnet into my machine, automatically sent email to their systems administrator saying, somebody from your site just tried to telnet into my machine and they don't have an account here. And I thought you might like to investigate. And if you get another message like this, you might want to investigate harder. It means they're trying a lot. And we caught a whole bunch of people by simply putting that into TCP wrapper. So that's how useful it is. You can also have automated response, something that says, okay, they tried telnet 3 times. We're now going to cut off web services. Because, hey, they keep trying to telnet in. They're not authorized, so I'm not going to provide them with any services. Or in the case of Deception Toolkit, what it does is it augments the TCP wrapper's access control file so you can automatically switch somebody over to all deceptions. Or you can give it a secure ID type of token or a one-time password, and it'll authorize a service. So there's no legitimate service authorized until you prove your identity, and then it authorizes one-time use of Telnet or some other service. So you can now come in and use that service over the internet, whereas nobody else could have. So these are all things that are done by modifying the TCP wrapper's access control file. So it's not so limited automated responses, but they're somewhat limited. It provides hook into the existing operating system without having any operating system source. So you don't have to have the source of the operating system and it'll work. It's relatively easy to manage, just one file to control. It is a sequential machine. It's relatively low overhead, that is, it only takes overhead when you're using one of the services that it covers, and then only while it makes the access control decision and not afterwards. It's free, written to the university, and it's widely used. And you've seen how it's used and how it works before. Another example is a secure web server. This is also free and published out on the internet. It's a get-only web service. We described it briefly earlier. It's secure against corruption, denial of service, and leakage, at least more secure than alternative web servers. It's very easy to manage and configure. It works with TCP wrappers, faster than other web servers because it's limited function, and it's free for non-commercial use.
That's another tool. Tool I've been using for many years very effectively. And lots of people try to attack.
Another example is the firewall toolkit. This is a toolkit that allows you to very easily build proxy servers and such things. It's basically a full, it's a free version of what eventually became a commercial product. It's a full-featured application gateway. It includes an authentication daemon, file chain, FTP, HTTP, Gopher, Telnet, Sendmail proxies, and a plug, RLog and XLIN and a plugboard proxy. It allows you to just build your own proxy for everything you want to build a proxy for. You can, so in fact, you can proxy, for example, secure shells, if you should happen to really want to do that. I'm not sure that's a good idea, but, and it works sort of like TCP wrappers, only it does some more things. It's got that stateful capability so that when an FTP gets started, it will allow the ports from that IP address only for that FTP service, not for everything else that happens along and so forth. And it's very widely used, and it's freely available on the internet. Yes, sir?
So it's designate my proxy at home. Would I typically have to get into the proxy at school to forward all the stuff to my proxy?
If you use that for the proxy at home, would you have to get into the proxy at school to modify it to run through your proxy? It depends on how you do things. This proxy, you would not want to use for that. You'd want to write your own. Okay? What you really want is an anonymizer. Okay, that's really the services that you're talking about. I would advise you not to do anything to bypass the function of your school's server. If you have a legitimate use, what you really should do is get the administration of your school to authorize it or do it from home. Because really, what happens when you try to subvert the function of their firewall, there are a couple of things that happen. One of them is, if they find out, you get in trouble. Another thing is, you may be weakening their overall security, even though you think you're only getting additional service outbound, that may now allow somebody else to get something else inbound because of some vulnerability that you've introduced that you don't know about. All right, so you really should go with the system. Okay, and hopefully the system is designed to let you do things that are good things to do. Now, you know, not all systems are that way, and if you go and get around their controls, then they might say, good job, wonderful idea, or they might say, you're in big trouble, and you know, you're out of luck. So my personal ilk is ask permission. Others say, don't ask permission, ask forgiveness. I won't make value judgments. But I will tell you that you won't be able to return to any of my classes if they say you've done it and you weren't supposed to.
Commercial products. All right, so there are various commercial products. There are routers, packet filters, application gateways, remote control and administration packages, administrative tools, control, testing, evaluation methods,
and even full service organizations that will do soup to nuts for you.
They say basically you pay us to be your internet service provider. We'll provide the firewall, we'll provide the proxy, you give us the rules, we'll take care of it, we'll manage the attacks, we'll detect it, we'll send you information on what we've caught for you, what we've done for you lately, so on and so forth. Routers and packet filters we've talked about is something you can buy. It's really too low level for many of the issues you need to address in firewalls today. They're hard to properly manage. They do have very high performance, limited utility. They're limited in your ability to customize them, and they tend to be very hard to test adequately
because you don't have any control over what's in them or even visibility.
Application gateways are hard to manage. They don't handle low-level issues at all, typically. So if you don't have a router out in front of your application gateway, you can get some low-level attack that will defeat you. But you probably should have a router out in front unless you're really willing to live at the edge. Although you can, using off-the-shelf tools like IPfilter, and what's the Linux version of IPfilter? IFWAdmin is the old one, and IPChange is the new one. These can effectively provide functions very similar to what a packet filter can provide inside a regular Unix or Linux box. So those are alternatives. So in fact, a lot of people implement a packet filter in their general purpose computer. It's not quite as reliable, but it does work. And that'll help you handle low-level issues. They're very complex and error-prone. It's really hard to get an application gateway right, especially if you're not doing anything else. They require very good host security. You basically have to be an expert at securing that host. And if you make any little mistake in securing that host, you're in big trouble. It helps if you have a trusted computing base for your application gateway, a really securely designed operating environment. They're expensive, they're hard to use, but for this particular purpose, they are very well justified and worth the effort. They're very customizable. So you can basically re-rig an application gateway to do anything, including things you really don't want to do. So you got to be real careful about what you do with them. They're impossible to fully test. Right? Whereas routers are very hard, application gateways, it's impossible. There's no hope for doing a complete test to make sure that it really does exactly what it's supposed to all the time. And it's almost certain that it doesn't. But the question is whether the bad guy will ever figure it out. Or how quickly you'll detect it and react to it, whatever. In fact, the truth is most application gateways you get out in the commercial world are rarely tested at all.
So that's just the nature of it. Do you have a question?
Deer staring at deadline.
The question in there somewhere, is there something like this? Remote control administration, there are a few products that do this. They require encryption for this remote administrative function. This is typically when you have multiple firewalls controlling multiple entry points to your environment, and you want to have the same policy and the same set of safeguards at all of them, and you don't want to have administrators trying to coordinate all this manually. They only interoperate with the same pipe, so that if you have two identical firewalls, they can typically interoperate. Note that no two firewalls are in fact identical, if only because they have different IP addresses. But other than that, you can probably do a pretty credible job. They usually have inadequate administrative support and for the remote control function itself. They are very useful for labor reduction. They go under the category of tools like secure network management tools. So if you have five gateways to the internet, one for each continent, for example, then it's probably much less expensive, more efficient to manage it centrally than to have five 24/7 staff configured to manage all five of them. They're primarily useful in large organizations, large and highly distributed organizations. Administrative tools and controls are out there. A few of them are easily managed. Mostly, it's very hard to manage what they do. And the controls that they have on them are almost all inadequate. That is, for example, you can almost never actually figure out what this tool is going to do. And in fact, not only can you not tell what is exactly is going to happen from the specification that you gave it, they also, for example, have inadequate audit capabilities. For example, they don't provide you with a set of tests to demonstrate that the tool is doing what your configuration is set to do. Right? You put in a configuration, magic happens, some guy wrote a program, right? And whatever that program does, it does. So if it does it right, great. If it does it wrong, too bad. There's no way to make sure. There's generally no capability provided to analyze the audits that are generated by the machines these things run on. So you get these change of control situations where I've just changed the configuration. I now have a different set of controls. How do I validate that the change was right and what's there now is right? And the answer is they don't have any way to do that. They don't provide mechanisms to analyze the configuration, for example, typically to tell who is allowed where. IP change actually does this. You can make a request of IP change and it will tell you if you sent this kind of packet in, what would be allowed and what would not be allowed. But most of them don't even have that. And IP change is so low level, there is an administrative tool with it. It's called you change the sequence of commands that take place. If there was a tool, it wouldn't have a method for analysis. And they have inadequate change control. That is, the ability to back out of a change and so forth. These tools typically don't provide it, although occasionally you'll find one that does. There's the problem of testing and evaluation. For example, for the most part, current firewall technologies do not provide you with automated test generation. See, what you'd like to do is, when you configure the firewall, it generates for you a sequence of tests that will automatically You take them out of the firewall, you put them on the outside or on the inside, you run the test, and it demonstrates, it proves that the configuration does what it's supposed to do and doesn't do what it's not supposed to do. Now, you can't manually do that. Right? It turns out automation is the right way to do this. You take that specification, you turn it into a sequence of tests that will provide you some assurance that it does the right thing. But nobody provides automated test generation tools for this, even though there are automated test generation tools that could be converted for this purpose. It's not possible to do a complete test. There's no current products out there that generate automatic tests. All you have is these sort of, you know, crappy tools like IFS that will scan for 25 or 50 or 100 known vulnerabilities, which is doesn't tell you that it does what it's supposed to do and doesn't do what it's not supposed to do. All it tells you is when I telnet it in to port 25 and try to send me a hole number 3, it didn't work. Maybe it should have worked. Right? Maybe I was running that version of sendmail, and from the IP address I came from, it was supposed to, but from this other IP address, it wasn't supposed to. These tools will not tell you that. Right? Especially if your firewall is configured to allow certain things from certain places and not allow other things from other places, you need to be able to test that it is allowed where it's allowed and not allowed where it's not allowed, and nothing generates those tests for you. Basically, you can't test firewalls from the inside. Another big problem. So, a lot of people configure their firewall and they look at the inside, it seems to work, they're done. Excuse me. Doesn't matter what it does from the inside. You know, the question is what does it do from the outside? Actually, it does matter what it does from the inside, but it also matters what it does from the outside. So to do a test, you need to get to the outside of the firewall and test it. So in order to test the firewall, you need another internet connection somewhere that doesn't run through the firewall. Right? Which is against the rule of are you supposed to run a firewall? All right, so what you really need is outside the firewall, a portion of your internet that's out there that allows you to test as if you were the internet against your firewall, which you can then disconnect during normal operation so that they won't break into that as a way to explain. Remote testing was available for a while from all.net. We abandoned it. There are other places that will give you free remote tests, but they won't guarantee you that what they actually found is what they're going to report to you. Mostly they do it for sales purposes. I think you can probably, you know, call up ISS and say, give me a free test, and they'll say, okay, let us, you know, give us the name of your buying decision person, and our salesman will contact you about a free test. So they'll give you a free test with the idea of trying to prove that you have some vulnerabilities so they can then sell you the product. And of course, that makes the for-fee legitimate testing services harder to carry out. So it's a competitive advantage, but it puts out of business for legitimate testers in favor of the people that are only testing to sell their services, which means they're not testing very well. It's fairly rare for people to do periodic testing, like every day or every hour, every month or every year. Normally, if you're going to do a test, you should do it periodically. Now, if you're going to eat in a class of people, you should bring food for everybody. There's a, you know, front, oh, thank you, there you go. Just tell them, don't come. I don't want to say. Random testing is very rare, right? If you're going to do effective testing, it's nice to do a test, you know, every Tuesday at 2 p.m. we're going to do a test to make sure the fire alarm works. Okay, but if we're going to test how people behave, which is what a response to attacks on firewalls is all about, if we're going to test how the firewall behaves, we need to be able to do it randomly without, you know, blind testing is even better. Right? So that the people being tested don't know what to test. So they do the right thing. Or they don't do the right thing, but we test it, right? We're testing the overall system, not just some piece of technology. Okay, so almost nobody does this sort of blind random testing of their capabilities. Several major providers are available as full service vendors. They provide a broad range of services. Very few guarantee anything, and none of them will take on liability if something goes wrong. So basically they're saying, pay us money, and we'll do the best we can, we'll keep sending you reports to say we're doing good, but if something bad happens, too bad. You can switch to another provider who will give you the same guarantee. But until somebody gives them a better guarantee and has the money behind it, that's about what's going to happen. The cost is lower to get one of these full service vendors than running it yourself. And they will probably actually do a better job, in many cases, of running a good secure firewall. Because they do this all the time, they're practiced, they're knowledgeable. You typically don't have the same expertise they do, especially the good ones. Look out for the fly-by-night operations, but there are some very legitimate ones out there. They can be a pain to deal with. Now, the other side of this is that you have to trust it all to them. right? Because they're there. They see everything. They have unlimited access. So you're trusting it all to somebody out there, or you're paying to do the job. You don't know who they're going to hire tomorrow, or what processes they have in place, or whether they're going to change their processes, or whether you can really trust. Of course, you don't know whether you can really trust your people either. But the point is, you're trusting it all to somebody else. It might be good to hire them and then also have your own stuff inside. They're in your pocket and in your network. Okay? In your pocket, as in, if you decide to change, you don't have the expertise or the knowledge or any of the other stuff because you decide to buy it from somebody else, which means that you now become dependent on them. And a lot of people don't like becoming dependent on other people for their critical security issues. So the summary of the commercial product area today is hard to manage, limited policy coverage, no standards, if there are no standards at all in it. There's inadequate procedures, only partial technical safeguards, they don't support audits, the documentation is okay, and they have minimal response capability. Also, they don't support testing. They don't generally address the physical protection issue, that is, how do you make sure that everything from the firewall to your physical assets are protected as well as the things you're protecting with it. Right, if some vendor is doing it, down in Fremont, and you're in Los Angeles, there's something between Fremont and Los Angeles that has to be physically secured as well as Fremont is secured and as well as Los Angeles is secured. And have you addressed that? Or else that has to be covered in some other way. Personnel issues are not typically addressed. Legal considerations are generally ignored by the commercial products. Basically, they say we're not responsible if it goes wrong. They ignore the issues of protection awareness. That they provide a service or a product, you need to make your people aware of how to use it safely. Right? If your users are downloading executables from the internet via their web browser and running them on your boxes, or if they're reading Word documents without macro protection, without macros turned off, then all that firewall stuff is not going to be of any great value. So you need to have your users aware of what they can and cannot do safely with the firewall in place to make the firewall effective. And the products don't deal with that at all. And they do a fair job of doing training and education for their customers. Otherwise, they would be having a difficult time selling to them. And also, the current market is largely piece parts. It's hard to buy that whole firewall. You buy a web server or a proxy or a gateway or a router. But if you want a vendor to give you the whole soup to nuts solution, bot, works, for my needs, my people are trained, they're experienced, installed, and all that, that's much harder to find, although it's becoming easier to find as the market develops, maturing.
Which brings us to the fact that generally the commercial world, the technology is not mature. The sole source solutions are becoming available. If you need at least one full-time system administrator for each firewall, and technology doesn't address issues as well for large organizations as for small organizations. So basically, the technology outruns the ability to manage it. At this point, I typically go through a couple of case studies. I'm going to talk, so in explaining why it is, basically every case is unique and every organization needs to do things in their own way, and for a variety of reasons. Not just because of technical limitations, or they want to do this and you want to do that, but because the organizations themselves can't stand it. I mean, suppose you wanted to implement a firewall here and not allow people to dial out, but somebody else owns the telephone system at some other location where you're saying you don't want them to dial out. Then there's internal politics, there's power. It says, no, I'm not going to allow you to control my phone switch because you're running the firewall somewhere else. So in that organization, you need to set the right goals for your firewall and what it's actually going to do and what it's not going to do and how it's going to work. And that's different from the next organization where they're controlled in the same way or where there is no telephone switch or where you're multinational instead of local and so forth. So these case studies are intended to cover a broad spectrum of different things. We have a major financial firm, a big electronics firm, a small consulting firm, and a big information services provider as examples. And we're just going to talk briefly about what was done there. At the big financial firm, they had literally billions
tens of billions of dollars in assets under their control, 10,000 plus employees, 20,000 plus computers, yes, two computers per employee or so. They are networked globally, basically in every country of the world. There's real-time financial transfers, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They have one internet gateway that handles all their internet traffic. They have a dual host firewall, and it's custom constructed. We looked at this firewall, and we found that they have two full-time staff assigned to this firewall. They purchase new technology every 2 years. So whatever the technology is, it's a 2-year replacement cycle. They need to purchase ongoing consulting assistance just to keep the thing up to date. They use a single external interface. They have weak internal firewalls that operate as Chinese walls that meet the financial requirements. They budget only $300,000 per year.
Extraordinarily inexpensive to that organization.
Since the advent of internet commerce, that situation has changed. Because instead of supporting a few of their users going out to the internet, they're now supporting, you know, millions and millions of bank transactions a day over the internet. So if you look at them today, it would be very different. This was a couple of years ago. This is a major manufacturer that has billions of dollars in annual sales, 10,000 employees, 5,000 computers. Basically, they have manufacturing labor that doesn't use computers. Right? They're working on assembly lines. And a smaller number of people that are higher tech that have more computers. Global network, they have time-critical design transfers, several internet gateways. They use a gateway router firewalls throughout, and they're again custom constructed.
I just want to note that if you look here, you're going to see that most,
If you're a large high-tech company, say $1 billion or more in high-tech, chances are you run your own firewall as your own custom configuration. If you're 100 million or less, or you're not high-tech, chances are you have somebody else's firewall, somebody else runs it. And so it sort of makes sense. As a manufacturer, basically they needed a custom firewall because they're doing stuff differently than everybody else does. I mean, they're doing just-in-time orders and deliveries that have special protocols, special deals with special clients. They're getting design information in from this guy and putting it out to that guy with separate subparts provided by a third party and so forth. So they need to build it customer. It's just not going to happen. They figured out how to get the funding for their custom firewall. They combined it with performance upgrades. Basically, they said, we're going to go from like 9,600 baud to T1. And it's going to cost us this much. And oh, by the way, we're going to also add security. Turns out, 3/4 of the price was security. But, that's how they got it through the management process. They provide base services to all staff members, special services on an as-needed basis with authorization. They have a whole team of administrators around the world so that they always have somebody awake and watching their global network of firewalls at any given time. So if there's a problem anywhere in the world, there's always somebody to call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They might be in Kuala Lumpur, but they all understand how the firewalls work and they all speak some version of English. So they do have a common mode of communication. They share incident response around the globe. They share the training costs. They have it in 4 locations, it's on 4 different continents. They get corporate support. They budget around $750,000 a year. This has a lot to do with the money differential from place to place. If it was all done in U.S. dollars in the Bay Area, it'd be $1.2 million. If you're doing it in Hoboken, if you're doing it like in central Ohio somewhere, it's still $750,000. Small consulting firm, less than $1 million in annual sales, maybe 10 to 20 employees with 20 to 40 computers, global network only via the internet, so they're using the internet to communicate between the consultants. And basically they include client information in these transfers, so it's sensitive data. And each one has their own internet gateway. Typically it's just a proxy server of some sort that sits off of their cable modem or what have you. Their router gateway firewalls for one site, so everybody else comes into that one site to get the common database information that goes does their own processing at their own location. And it's custom constructed.
very different sort of solution.
Basically, the way this is all rigged, each consultant has a dial-in link. And they minimize the confidential traffic that goes over the internet. They use encryption if they want it to be secure. They provide a non-routing firewall at the main site with the insiders can log in for access. They log into this firewall and go from there to the internal network. There's no outside access allowed to the inside network at all except through that process. It costs them about $5,000 a year to implement this, and but they don't budget for time, because they're all independent consultants and they run their consulting firm. So they figure their time is free.
Although if they charge their clients for it, it'd probably be a couple $100,000 a year. But you know how that goes.
The major internet service provider has billions of dollars in annual sales, more than 50,000 employees, more than 30,000 computers. Yes, it's true. Major ISPs tend to have fewer computers than employees, because a lot of those employees are dealing with electronic devices and routers and so forth. And they don't have their own computers. They're configuring hardware and telephone switches and so forth. They're corporate computers that multiple people work on. They're globally networked. They have time-critical information services. Basically, if they're down for more than a couple of minutes, they start getting phone calls. If they're down for more than a couple of hours, people switch providers. And in about 3 days to 5 days of outage, they're out of business. And they'll never be in business again. They have many, many internet gateways because they're in the internet gateway business. Everything is an internet gateway. They have a lot of different firewalls. They have all sorts of clients that have different custom things that they do. They have their own firewalls for their own subsystems. They use commercial providers, all sorts of providers all over the place. And basically, you know, their decision was to provide top-flight internet firewall capability and augment it with internal controls. They have two full-time firewall experts that are just working there all the time on the firewall. They use custom solutions for each service. So they'll write a special purpose proxy for this web service. If they're going to do a different web service, they'll write another special purpose proxy. They'll roll it all from scratch. They have a distributed secure network capabilities that they rely on. It uses a variety of things, including access controls, physical controls, encryption, and so forth. They have multiple internal firewalls for separation of different portions of their business function from other portions. They buy off the shelf wherever they can. They customize as needed. They budget about $2.2 million a year for their firewall.
Much more serious problem.
That's probably gone up since then. All right, so who should build their own and why? And
here's a sample architecture if you really wanted to build one and a sense of what it will cost you.
Basically, large organizations in high-risk category with business requirements for interconnect and technical expertise in-house and strong corporate support should be building their own firewalls. If you don't have these things, you should be buying stuff from other people. The reasons, good reasons to build your own, one of them is current technology is not adequate to really protect you. So if you're high risk, if you have a lot at stake and you have the expertise to do better than off the shelf, then that's what you need to do, is better than off the shelf. The risks are too high to ignore, right? If you're in a banking business and you lease your firewall from somebody else who runs it for you, and you're putting $10 billion of customer assets at risk every day, that is, you can lose $10 billion in a day, no problem, in a substantial financial institution, then that's probably a bad idea, right? I mean, you need to do a better job of risk management. The expertise is available, right, because you have a strong technical base inside, so you have the ability to do it. You have concern about vendor support and the ability to do your own support. If building also leads to understanding, okay, when you build your own firewall, you start to understand a lot more about what's really going on, not only what was going on historically, but what's going on today, every minute. And that understanding is what allows you to respond effectively. You can't respond out of reflex. If you respond out of reflex, every new thing that comes up, you won't have the right reflex for it. You need to respond out of knowledge. You need to see what's going on, figure out what it means. What are they trying to do? What's the effect going to be on me? What can I do about it? Find a short-term, medium-term, and long-term solution and implement it and have that capability. And you have to do that on your own. You can't depend on somebody else to do that for you. course, that understanding leads to proper, or at least better, operation.
Here's an example architecture that I did for a client once. Basically, you have the world up at the top, and there's a router, gateway router, that goes to the inside. In addition to assure continuity of services, there were spare gateway servers that could be turned on. So if the original gateway went down for one reason or another, in a matter of a minute or two, you could flip on an alternative gateway, and you might lose the current session, but the service overall wouldn't go down. People will retry. To administer it all, basically using the serial ports and the console ports on all the gateways, the serial ports on the routers, there's an administrative box that has a bunch of serial ports on it. It's not otherwise connected to a network. So you do all the administration from that box. You configure what the controls are going to be for the router, and you download the router configuration only over the serial port. So it's configured, so there's no other physical way to get to it. The administrative console is in the same physical location as everything else, so there's no other way to control them. There you are. You're in total control of these boxes. You have the spare, so if somebody eats the gateway, you can just shut off the gateway and flip over to a spare for now. Maybe disable the services, maybe look at packet logs. And in addition, this guy has a packet watcher. And the packet watcher is one of those clever things that only I do. Right? Basically, what this packet watcher does is it watches the world, watches the inside of the router, watches the inside of the outer router, the outside of the inner router, and the inside of the inner router. But it can't write anything. Right? It's got, you know, fiber optic connections with the return wire SNP. All it can do is watch what happens. Nothing else. And all this packet watcher does is compares the packets out in the world to the packets on the inside of the outer router. And if it finds any packet on the inside of the outer router that corresponds to a packet in the world that it doesn't think should be there by its version of the rules, it screams. It says, hey, a packet got through it wasn't supposed to get through. No fair. Not going to happen. Same thing with the rest of this configuration. So basically, it's comparing packets. It has an independent copy of what the rules are for this thing. And if it sees any violation of the rules, it's completely independent of the rest of the system. It doesn't matter why it went wrong. It's going to scream, it went wrong. Now, it's up to you to fix it, but that's not the watcher's problem. So this gives you a completely independent test of everything that's going on and detection in real time of stuff that's not supposed to happen. Cost to build this. This is in a couple years old dollars. Basically, hardware, software, people, and consultants, about $250,000 a year to run such a firewall. Keep it up to date and operating. Probably in the Bay Area it's more expensive, and New York it's more expensive, and London is more expensive, and Ohio is cheap. I just come from Ohio. I know. It's half as cheap. Half as expensive, whatever. Now, again, remembering up in the upper right-hand corner of this theme, the suitability of a firewall can only be properly understood in the context of the overall protection program. I want to talk a little bit about the government's issues related to firewalls, in particular about protection management policy, standard procedure, technical safeguards, audits, documentation, and response testing, physical protection personnel, legal awareness, training, education, and organizational suitability. I think I, at the beginning of the course, pointed out that those were my perspectives, and now I'm going to sort of walk through them. One of the issues in firewall protection management, basically, you need to understand that information and information technology are valuable assets and must be protected commensurate with their value, which leads to the question of who is responsible for protection, is it a committee, what are the roles of the committee, what's the power sharing, that is, how is this decision process about what's going to go on in this firewall made? It's an organizational issue. Yes, sir. Information technology.
It is.
IT. The other question that's a management question is who pays for this thing? It's all great, you know, lots of people have rules, no money. Right, here's the rule. You need to be able to detect any bad thing that happens to your firewall. Here's your funding, $10,000 a year. Sorry, not going to happen. Can't do it. So, is it done by the corporation? Is it done by the business units? Is it done by the users? Who pays for what? And of course, who pays for it often dictates what actually happens. You say, I'm not allowed to have that service by corporate policy, but I'm the one that's funding the damn firewall. So if I said I'm going to get real audio, I'm going to get real audio, or you're not going to have a firewall, and that's that. So that has to be dealt with. How are the disputes though? Is there an adjudication process when the senior corporate vice president comes over and says, I want real audio on my desk?
I want to dial in from Europe, you know, from France, or I guess encryption is allowed in France. I want to dial in from Italy and do financial transfers of hundreds of millions of dollars of corporate funds at a whim for my laptop PC. Who in the corporation is authorized to say, no, it had better not be the firewall administrator? Right? The firewall administrator's proper job is to say, oh, boss, help! Somebody's decision. You know, here's the rule. The rule says you need to get a sign off by the CEO for that kind of decision. Or whoever it is that signs it off, there's a rule. There's an adjudication process if they say no, an appeals process, some way to change the rules. That's properly an administration management issue. How do we audit the asset protection? Okay, auditing is a management responsibility. Right? If you're the boss, your job, among other things, is to make sure that your people are doing what they're supposed to do. So you need to have auditors that you hire that do that job. They need to be independent so that they don't get in trouble if they report that there are bad things happening. In fact, usually we want our auditors to be people who will find bad things. Any decent auditor will never be happy unless they've found flaws. Okay? And I've done audits where things look pretty good, and I started to sweat. And I said, look, these guys are paying me a lot of money. If I don't find any flaws here, you know, I better be damn sure there aren't any flaws if I don't find them. I've always found them. Sometimes they're picky, and people complain that auditors are always so picky, but that's the auditor's job, to be as picky as it takes to find what the limitations are. And then it's management's decision whether those limitations are important enough to justify the decisions about risk. The auditor's job to find the problem. Do we have internal audit, external audit, how much, how often, so forth? Who makes the whole thing work?
That's the management's decision.
Policy issues. What are the assets? What is it we're trying to protect? We need to identify them. We need to assess value. Right? If we're protecting things commensurate with the value, we needed a mechanism for assessing value. What's it worth? It's worth, you know, $25. I'm not going to protect it. Forget it. Not worth the firewall to protect $25. You know, what are the protection requirements? By the way, it is worth the firewall to protect $25 200 million times. Just not one. What are the requirements? Integrity, availability, confidentiality, some other requirements? What do you want this thing to do for you? That helps you figure out what you're going to do. What are the relative priorities under various circumstances? Okay, normally, availability is important. But if somebody should succeed in getting past the firewall, can we get rid of availability, shut down service in order to prevent them from leaking our secrets, or in order to prevent them from corrupting our database that's controlling cars on the highway? Right? What is the limit of what we can do under what circumstances? That's a policy issue. Who's responsible for what? Who makes the decisions? Who implements them? Who do you call? How is it paid for? It's a policy issue, not something you do when you run the firewall. How are disputes handled and other governance rules should be in the policy related to the firewall. And policy, among other things, means hard to change. Hard to overcome, basic process. Standards and procedures. Who defines what the standards are and what the procedures are? Is as an example, is it the incident response team with some committee approval that decides the procedures for dealing with incidents? Or does the incident response team just respond and they don't have any decision power? Right? What are we doing? Who carries these things out? Is it carried out by everybody at their own level? Or if something happens, is the procedure that you call the right person who's supposed to carry out that business function? Is there a union issue? Right? Yeah, I can fix it. But we need the carpenters union, so we can't turn the firewall back on until the carpenters come and fix this piece of carpet, and that's that. Or fix that wall. That's it. If that's the rule, that's the rule. Who documents compliance? Okay? Somehow, if you have standards and procedures, you're supposed to be compliant to them. There has to be a way to document that compliance. And you know, is it the people that follow the rules that document it? Is it the managers who manage them that document it? How does that whole thing work? Who verifies the compliance? Is that internal and external audit or some other process that verifies, you know, you have procedures and standards, how do you make sure you're following them? Technical safeguards. Who decides on them? Is it the local administrator with working with the incident response team? That's a good way to do it. That may not be the way you do it. Is it verified by some outside expert? Is it decided on by some high-priced consultant who doesn't actually have to do it? I'm available, thank you. Well, you'll pay me a lot of money, I can make your decisions for you, and then I don't have to deal with it if it doesn't work. That's a good deal. It's a good deal for me, it's not a good deal, you know, if you're the one that's actually implementing it. But you need to, you know, just have these decisions made in a certain way. Who implements them? The local administrators? Every user? Is the incident response team tasked with helping you implement these things? Is that going to help them do their incident response? Are they the same team? You know, basically every user has some responsibility, right? If every user is downloading executable files from the internet via the web and running them on their PCs, your network's not going to be secure and the firewall's not going to save you. So somehow everybody has their role, and they have to know what their role is and how to implement. Who verifies the technical safeguards? Is it the manager? Is the manager capable of doing that? Internal audit, external audit? Independent testers? Who tests them? Testing service, internal testers, the incident response team? Might be a good set of people to test them. Maybe you have a red teaming capability. How do you audit the firewall? There's internal audit and external audit. How often do you audit? Every network system, once every couple of years? Every site, once a year, perhaps? Every substantial server, once a quarter, perhaps? Every firewall, once a month? Who knows? You need a decision about how often, how important, you know, you need this independent verification. External audit, typically, get an overall scheme is audited once a year. Have somebody from the outside look at the whole thing and say, you know, you forgot about the phone system. And it all runs through the phone system, so maybe we should just, you need an external audit once in a while to find things that you might have missed because you're found in your context. You need maybe internal auditor reports of your firewall once a quarter. Certainly every firewall should be audited maybe something like once a quarter is a good idea. Random samples. Should you do random selections of subsystems to audit once a month or something like that for a firewall that's highly critical in a high-risk organization?
You have other audit mechanisms, maybe, that are interlinked with your testing program.
How do you document this thing? You know, is it created by the users, the administrators, the incident response team? Who documents what part of the process, right? There's an incident response process associated with the firewall. Who documents it? The firewall administrator, the incident response team?
Who maintains the documentation, right?
Oh, gee, we changed what we're doing, but didn't bother to write it down, and then I left. The new guy doesn't know what it is we're doing. But he has to do it. So he's using the old procedure because I never changed the documentation. So you need a process to make sure that works right. Where is it kept? Okay, I have my firewall documentation. It's kept in the safe down on 32nd Street. Unfortunately, the firewall's down right now. Well, let's all go for a drive. They've broken in. So another one is, a lot of people these days keep their documentation online. This is not denial of service attack. Online documentation is not going to save you. So you need it, like, usually physically located with the thing it's protecting, with all the information you need to get it working again, at least to the point where you can read the rest of the documentation. It's good to have it pre-positioned. Who verifies it? Right? Typically, you write the document, but nobody actually tests it. So somebody independently should, like, do everything that the document says to make sure that when they actually do it, it actually does it. Right? Oh, I forgot to mention, there's a password there. What was it? I don't know. He died. He got hit by a car. Uh-oh. Looks like we're going to have to break into the secure server to get it to work right.
Oh, okay. Right. How secure was that server?
Incident response. Typically, you know, does the incident response work for or are they on the committee that makes the decisions about this firewall? Or is this incident response team, you know, some guy that gets called in who had no choice about anything here, and now I have to figure out how to respond. It's much more effective, typically, if the incident response team is represented on the decision process. The incident response team get to help define protection, perhaps with the approval of the overall committee. Hopefully, the incident response team handles the incident. If they don't, that's an issue. Typically, real-time, 24/7, all around the world, but not always. Some organizations, you don't need that. Somebody broke into the firewall Tuesday night. Everything shut down Tuesday night. We have a big party. We can't get anywhere. We don't do any services. Everything's turned off. Go ahead. We'll fix it Wednesday morning. We're a small company. Who does the awareness training? It's very worthwhile to have the incident response team involved in the awareness training for a couple of reasons. One of them is that it means that the people who are calling for help know the people that are going to help them. That's very useful. Another thing is, if you're going to have users calling the incident response team, it's very important that the users understand what to tell the incident response team, and it's probably the incident response team that should be telling the users what I need to know. If somebody else does the briefing and they don't know, they say, well, I don't know, you call them up when you got a problem. You're going to be overwhelmed with problems, but they're not incidents. What should you report? When? Also, of course, the people that do incident response know about the incidents. So it's really useful to have them in the training because they can say, hey, here's what happened last year. You know, Billy Bob, over in accounting, sent a love note to Mary Jane that said, oh, by the way, here's the password to get in and send me a love note back. That love note, you know, went to Joe's department store where Billy the hacker worked. He picked up the love note and he broke into our network. So you should know about that incident so next year you don't do the same foolish thing again. The incident response team, typically they should be tracking and reporting on all the incidents. You know, one of the things that I see very commonly in large organizations is there are lots of incidents that never get reported. Or when they do get reported, they never get tracked in some sort of a central system. They're just sort of handled and it disappears. And what that means is you don't know overall what's happening to your network. Are there more attacks now than there were last year? Are all sorts of things going wrong all over the place, but we just didn't know about it? Right? Is there some distributed coordinated attack underway and we can't figure it out because we don't have the wherewithal to coordinate all that information together? Also, of course, tracking incidents allows you to keep track of what the solution was. So if we have a simple solution that somebody spent 20 hours working on last week, instead of spending the 20 hours again this week, if we look it up in the database and it says, type Z, it worked. Oh, it worked, thank you, move on. So centralizing or at least coordinating this information is very helpful. Does the incident response team work on protecting, implementing protection or not? If they work on it, they'll know a lot more about what's there when they have time to respond to an incident. It's very useful to have that collaboration, but maybe you want independence. Do they help define the tools and train in their use? So look, I have a virus detector. I'm on incident response team. I didn't get to choose the virus detector. Now I have a user out in the field who's calling me and saying, I'm using, you know, Norton antivirus. But the incident response team never saw Norton antivirus. They were using, like, some other antivirus. What should I type? I don't know. What does your screen say? It says, press enter to continue. Oh, I don't know. Press enter. Oh, okay, the virus continued. It destroyed my files. Oh, no problem. I don't know what it meant because I've never used it. So it's very helpful if the people that do incident response to find the tools and train the people on how to use them so that they know how to communicate back and forth when an actual incident happens. They don't start from scratch trying to figure out a new tool. It's good to, perhaps limit the time that you're involved in an incident response or, track involvement in incident response because you don't want to have the same people doing that same thing for a very long time because they get to know too much. Or they have gained too much access or seen too many attacks on too many systems. Some of them get burned out. Maybe people get too used to seeing them and running away. it should be a path to advancement.
Protection testing. Internal testing. You do it typically, by administrators and programmers or after significant changes in configurations, periodically with automated tools or continuous for select functions. So you need an internal testing program, you need internal auditors to do testing as part of every audit. It's not enough to say it was blue, you'd like to test it to make sure it was actually blue. And external auditors, on demand, periodic, random, blind. You can test the whole response system, not just the firewall. Use guest testers. I like to have guest testers once in a while. Somebody that doesn't know anything about it, that we don't know anything about, it's the guest tester. They might come up with something that we missed. I like having guests also to make new friends. With all the publicly available tools, right? You should be testing with every tool that's out on the internet to see whether any of them work against you. There are a lot of those tools now, which means you need a lot of resources to do all these tests, or you need somebody that builds tests that cover them all. Testing from the inside as well as from the outside, necessary and appropriate.
physical protection. Do you need anything special for the firewall? Do you need it for every firewall, for all parts of the firewall, and to what standard? Generally, I say every part of the firewall should be physically protected, same level as everything is protecting. Otherwise, it becomes a vulnerability. Personnel issues, there's a certain thing that we do. We tend to punish victims instead of helping. What we should be doing is punishing perpetrators, like don't hire one-time attackers, or do thorough background checks. Don't hire people that have been convicted of a computer crime. Now, I get, like, lambasted for this position. I don't know why. Help the victims. You know, like, reward people who report incidents with performance points. Hey, you reported an incident. It took your time out of your job to tell us about a problem that the whole organization was affected by. You get an award. You did a good job, right? As opposed to, congratulations, you won the, you get screwed because you're the one that told us about an award, right? So recognition is good. You need to reward the defenders, like with prestige and advancement, training, pay, benefits, travel, networking. Send money to them. The point is that you won't get good defenders unless they're well rewarded for it. If there's no path to advancement, you won't get your best people working on defending your systems, and it takes good people to do this. You need to coordinate it effectively. Coordinate the IT processes with the human resources and the job changes so that when somebody changes jobs, the people that run the firewall know that they're no longer authorized to access that database, so they can fix the firewall and update it. You need to verify and track the training, awareness, and education program. Track the protection activities with performance, so your performance results, for your job performance results, are tracked to how well you work the information protection side of the organization. I have, 15 misconfigured machines. I shouldn't get a real good performance report because I brought in more money. Well, the reality is, of course, I will. But somehow you should have that performance tied to what you do in protection. Legal considerations, you want to enhance your corporate's legal expertise or get a specialist for this issue because it's very complex and part of the law that's very tricky. You need to have adequate notice, audit, and reporting. You need normal business records, your record retention requirements, you have interface with law enforcement and government that may require special legal considerations. There are liability issues, employee contract issues, whether you can observe employees' activities and what you can observe and how you can track it and who can watch it and how you respond to threats and what are your contracts with vendors and clients and everybody else relating to how the firewall works. You need evaluation and approval policies and procedures and so forth. What are the corporate responsibilities? If somebody breaks into a machine and uses a springboard to attack somebody else, what's the liability associated with it? What are the corporate records responsibilities? To what extent are the officers of the corporation responsible if the firewall does or does not do what it's supposed to? All employees need to get trained on awareness, maybe by the incident response team or on relevant topics would be nice. You need posters, newsletters, awards, email, all sorts of techniques available. Typically, active learning works better. You need notification, perhaps as part of people's contracts or sign-on procedures or periodically when you make changes in the system or part of employee evaluations. You may have to make sure that you can demonstrate that they are aware, not just that they are aware, but that you can prove it. You need to train the users on who to call, when to call, experience with tools and procedures. They're not looking at some screen they've never seen before when it comes to an emergency. Yet the employees, programmers, and analysts have to understand the typical errors and omissions, how to design for integrity and availability, what are the rules of the road for their use of the systems. The managers have to understand how to make prudent decisions in real time. They need to be reasonable in their way that they respond to incidents and how to react to them. They have to understand how the process works and how to properly manage it. And they need to know how to deal with incident response teams, and you need to have proper, very thorough training for those skill expertise. Organizationally, upper management has to be supportive if it's going to be effective. Are the proper policies in place? What are the management challenges? How do you meet them? Is there enough budget? Is there enough need to have a firewall? Is the proper expertise in place? Is there proper corporate will to do the right thing? That this is often the biggest problem. But what is the right thing? Will the people work together? These are things that have to do with the organization. If the organization doesn't work, then the firewall's not. Okay, so I'm going to summarize and conclude. Basically, firewalls are not mature, operating costs are... All right, so there's a list of things. It's not a mature technology. The cost of operation far exceeds the buy-in cost. So it doesn't matter that it costs $50,000 per piece of equipment, it's going to cost $500,000 to use it. you need to expect to upgrade everything every 2 to 3 years.